This class here is five essentials of the middle grade novels. So if you accidentally stepped into the wrong room, this is your minute to sneak out. No offense taken. If you try to sneak out in 10 or 15 minutes, I'll know it's personal. I will find you and ask you what was wrong with me, because we all, as writers, are completely neurotic. And Shannon Hale, as you may or may not know, has officially classified becoming an author as a mental disorder. And I think she's spot on accurate with that. There is no doubt that we are in a crazy field. And here you are to get some ideas about writing the middle grade novel, which I am convinced is the best place to be writing. I love it, love it, love it. So I'm going to take you through things very quickly. In this kind of squished down screen sort of way, it's going to weird up all the graphics. This is me. I'm Jennifer Nielsen. These are the books that I have. This right here, this is the Elliot series of books. That's kind of an early middle grade. So this is for starting about second grade, as old as people want to read them. False Prince right here is more of an upper middle grade. It gets classified a lot as a YA, and I don't care how people classify it. I just wanted to buy it. That is the book at which Kimberly Griffiths Little and I, we share the same Scholastic publisher. The last book, if you quite cleverly notice that my name is not James Dashner, Infinity Ring is a new series that Scholastic is starting in August. It's going to replace the 39 Clues series. So 39 Clues is a geographic mystery that's, you know, kind of taking through these different geographical spots. It's linked to a computer game. That series has ended. Infinity Ring has begun. James is writing book 1 and 7. Matthew Kirby, also a Utah author, is writing book 5. I am writing book 6 of that series, which means of the 6 authors who are working on this Infinity Ring series, half of them come from Utah. And what you need to take from this is an understanding of what New York thinks about Utah authors. Because every time I'm back in New York, every time, there is somebody who will ask me, what's up with Utah? Like, what is it, the water or the polygamy or what? You know, they don't know. But what is it up with Utah? Because Utah, per capita, has one of the most active, high-quality author populations in the country. And so when you stick your return address onto a submission saying that it's from Utah, they know about Utah, and they are curious because people in New York don't understand a thing about it. They just know they love the writing that comes out of here. So that's a little bit about me. If I'm going to go fairly quickly through this presentation because I really want you to have an opportunity to ask questions at the end. Does anybody know when this gets out?
4:50.
All right.
It's the last one, so you can go on and on.
I will go on and on and on until you guys are like, I don't care if she hunts me down. I'm leaving. If you don't want to take notes, you can just hit the highlights of whatever I'm going to say. That's cool. Or I put it up on SlideShare. And SlideShare, the best way to find the presentation is you just on Google do SlideShare and use your search term for middle grade novel in quotes. So it hits it just like that. And if you do, it should take you straight to this exact PowerPoint presentation that you can download and have the whole presentation for yourself. And so, if you want to, you can. All right, to start off with the topic, middle grade readers. That is going to be kids who are leaving chapter books. So when they're finished with Magic Tree House and Junie B. Jones, they finished those, and they're ready for something bigger. That's the age it starts. It ends when they're ready for YA books. So it's not so much an age, it's a maturity and reading level sort of thing. You will have middle grade readers who are in first grade and they are ready for more complicated material. You will have kids in 8th or 9th grade who still, and maybe even 10th grade, who are not quite ready for YA. And so it's a very, very wide field. Developmentally, it is the hugest change in terms of what happens to kids in those years for that genre, or in that reading level, bigger than, you know, paper books, chapter books, or YA, is the middle grade area. So in order to understand how to write for middle grade readers, we have to understand the middle grade readers. So things that we know include, number one, a middle grade reader, they are ready for more abstract thought. Kids in chapter books, everything is very concrete, which means your villains are always completely evil, your heroes are always completely good, and it's this black and white sort of world. A middle grader is going to start to be able to see the grays in the world, and they like that. That is something that appeals to them because they are moving away from a more cartoon focus on the world into understanding the complexities. And so they do very much like that. Middle grade readers are intensely curious, which is why they love books that help them discover anything that they can discover. Discover new places, discover new emotions, discover something that, you know, they have a lot of curiosity about, is all a very, very good thing. Three, middle grade readers love useful knowledge, which means things that they learn in books that they can take home and put into their real world. So if they have a character that they're reading about who fixes their bicycle, and the kid's like, oh, that's how I fix the bicycle. And kids really love that because they're very much geared toward learning in their books. Now, here's the trick. They don't want to know that they're learning. Okay? They want to learn, but they don't come for fiction to learn or to get moralized to. I showed you the Infinity Ring book here. In Scholastic's goal with Infinity Ring is they call it subversive education, which means, because Infinity Ring is historical, so it's time-traveling adventure and hitting, you know, Columbus and the Vikings and the Renaissance and all of these times, but they want the book so cleverly disguised that the kid doesn't even know. You know, it's like, ha, 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 you learned, you know, sort of a thing, and, you know, to surprise the kids. Number four, they're very inconsistent. So what a middle grader, their very best friend this week could be their worst enemy next week and vice versa. Their favorite thing in the world next week could be the thing they hate most in the world. That's very normal, very much. If you're writing about a middle grade character, that's a totally, all kids will relate to that. And five on this one, they are egocentric. They believe, truly, sincerely believe, that they are the first one in the world ever to feel exactly this way. And the horrible thing that happened to them at school today, nobody has ever had such a thing happen, just them, alone in the universe with their emotion. And just very typical. Moving on, they have a developing sense of humor. Again, it's coming out of the SpongeBob where it's funny because he falls. They're starting to understand the structure of a joke, punchlines, and how to deliver it and how it is delivered. So they're ready for more sophisticated sorts of humor. They are fiercely loyal to their friends and to their values. Things that they believe firmly in. And right is right and wrong is wrong, and they stay very loyal to those ideas. Middle grade readers, if any of you have been around fifth and sixth and seventh graders, you know they're starting to kind of challenge authority and push just a little bit, but they are still at an age where they still want that positive response. And so they kind of engage in this sort of dance with authority figures where they're going to push and then get pushed back and push and push back. It's a normal developmental thing. And you will see it in middle grade characters all the time. That is a very common trait for characters. What are we on? Nine. They are idealistic and fair. They really do believe that, you know, there are happy endings still to be had in the world. And they are ready for moral questions, which is one of my favorite things because, you know, when you've got a kid in chapter books and they're dealing with Junie B. Jones' moral questions, it's like, well, should Junie have, you know, taken the sucker? And that's kind of the level that a chapter book kid is on, their whole moral question. And it's not even a moral question because obviously Junie should not have taken the sucker. Well, you get into chapter book, I mean, middle grade books, and now the kid is ready for something a little bit more. You know, the whole idea of like, well, is it okay to steal something if you're hungry enough and you don't have any other way to get food, like Boxcar Children. It's one of the reasons I loved Boxcar Children, because it plays with those moral decisions that those kids have to make, and it's wonderful. Okay, also things important to know, not necessarily developmental, but things you should know. Number one, you literally should know some middle graders, which means if you are teaching school and you meet them that way, if you have children that age, you know, when their friends come over to your house, if you have a church calling that you are working with middle graders, that is wonderful. If not, you know, go be the creepy person on the playground. Just, you need to know some middle graders. You know how they act, how they interact, how they relate, how they think, and these sorts of things. Because middle graders, and I'll talk about it in a little bit, they can spot a phony a mile off. And if you're trying to pretend that, you know, you get them and you don't, it will show through your writing every time. Okay, oh, that's what I'm going to show it. Middle graders can spot a phony. They do. So you can't fake your way through the writing. Number three, this is a huge one. Middle graders will read up and rarely down, which means if you are a 10-year-old, you don't want to read about an 8-year-old, but you will read and love to read about a 12-year-old. If you are on a 6th grade reading level, you will read up to a 7th or 8th grade reading level. You don't want to read down to a 3rd or 4th grade level. Middle graders instinctively push upward. Not always. There are going to be kids who are, you know, they love Diary of a Wimpy Kid, and they're in high school, and they will go backwards to read it. Generally speaking, they always want to go up. It's a good thing. That's how they get more mature. That's how their reading level goes up. Here's how you figure who's going to be reading your book. Take whatever age your main character is, okay? If you've got a 14-year-old main character, take the reading level that it's at, you know, it's an 8th or 9th grade reading level. Okay, so take whatever level you're at, bump it down a step or two, that's who's going to be wanting your book. That's your sweet spot, okay? So like when it's False Prince, he is a 14-year-old character. I get a lot of 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old readers who are reading up, all right? Not as many 15, 16, 17-year-old readers because kids don't like to go down. Okay, this is a big one. Middle graders live in the stories they love. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about, and it's going to sound like I'm pimping False Prince, and to be really honest with you, I totally am. And so, you know, if you want to go buy it in the bookstore, I am so okay with that. But I also have a point, too, about it. So, in False Prince involves a kid named Sage. And Sage is just kind of a punk, and he is mouthy, and he gets himself into trouble, and he's doing exactly the wrong thing that he should be doing all the time. Sage also is the hero in terms of he's fighting with the sword. And he's fighting some very bad guys who are more powerful than him. Sage in the initial writing was 16 years old. Because if you've ever had children, teenagers, you know there's a huge difference between a 16-year-old boy and a 14-year-old boy in terms of what they can handle. And I thought, Sage at 16, he could take on what he has to take on. So it's about the right age. And my editor comes back to me and she says, we are going to need to make Sage 14. And it was for the all-important reason that Barnes & Noble would not stock it as a middle grade book if he was older than 14. That's the only reason, just to get the Barnes & Noble shelf space they wanted. So Sage had to move. And I was so upset about it. And I'm talking to my editor on the phone, and I'm talking to my agent, and I'm like, there is no way Sage at 14 could do what he needs to do. He has to be older. And so my editor talks to me, and she says this. She says, Jen, and you can write this down because you're going to want to, so I'm just warning you now. She says, Jen, middle graders don't read for who they are. They read for who they wish they were. So I'll say it one more time. Middle graders don't read for who they are. They read for who they wish they were. Because what a middle grade reader will do is walk into the stories they love. When they're reading Percy Jackson, they are Percy Jackson. When they are reading Harry Potter, they are Harry, they are Ron, they are Hermione, whoever that character is that they identify with. And once she said that, once I understood that about middle graders, it was okay for me to change Sage's age. And I will get these letters from, you know, 11, 12-year-old boys, and they will write, oh, Sage is just exactly like me. You know, and it's so cool to read a character, and I'm like, I bet he's not. I bet he's not a thing like you. To be really honest, I bet sometimes that, you know, you think you might be, you're not the same. And yet that a kid could write me and think they are the same, it's because middle graders live in those stories. Yes, sir.
Does that still apply in how they talk? Or do you want them to talk more like a middle grader?
We're going to get into voice
okay.
in a little bit, because I think that's... I specifically will talk about that because I think it's a really important issue. I might even... Nope, I'm going to talk about it soon.
Okay.
Last one. Middle graders use books to explore their emotions. You know, they're in those ages where all of a sudden their hormones are misfiring and they're starting to branch out from mom's wing, and they're starting to feel things that's new. Social rejection, insecurity. They're starting to notice body type and be called out on their body type. They're starting to tell a joke and nobody laughs at it. They're starting to really experience what it's like to be afraid of something, you know, that's not just afraid of the dark. And books are the avenue through which middle graders begin to understand all of those new things. It's one of the reasons I love writing middle grade. Because how cool is it to think that you might write a book that in turn is going to help a middle grade student understand his or her own life? And at no, there's no other developmental stage more powerful than middle grade in order to help kids navigate the waters of their life. It's one of the great things about this age. All right. So we're going to talk about the five essentials of the middle grade novel. These are the five things that I think if you are writing middle grade that you need to, you know, just put as your checklist for any manuscript. Before I do this, I'm just curious. Is there anybody in here who is published with a middle grade novel right now? Okay. Anybody who has a finished manuscript and they're ready to submit it? You guys are awesome. Okay, sort of. Anybody who's got the idea, but it's not written or fully written yet. Okay, that gives me a really good idea. For those of you who have your manuscript and it's 80, 90% of the way to submission, go back and just check these things, because this will be the difference between yes, it gets accepted for publication, or no, it's not quite ready. We're starting with number one, a riveting main character. I like the word riveting. It is, in False Prince, it's Sage, this character, that's why it sold. And False Prince ended up with four publishers bidding on it, and it went to auction, and then Scholastic preempted the auction to say, what'll it take to pull it out? According to my editor, the reason they went that far was Sage. Just the voice of Sage. And she said she knew she was going to go that far in the first chapter for this book. That's main character. That's the kind of character you want to create, is somebody who people care about. I chose Harry Potter. Percy Jackson, the girl in the middle, that is Meg from Wrinkle in Time, because growing up, she was a huge role model of mine. So, your riveting main character, number one, needs to be passionate and intense. My first book that I put out was Elliot and the Goblin War. Before then, I was shopping around a manuscript called Apprentice to a Madman, which I thought plot-wise was spectacular. It was so cool. It had so much danger and magic and fights, and it was this great sort of cool world. And it really was, genuinely speaking, it was a cool manuscript. It got zero interest. If it could be less than zero, it got less than zero interest. Like, I don't even think that, you know, if I sent it off to an editor that they had to open up the envelope in order to reject it. They could just sense that they were going to not like it. And it was so frustrating to me when I was trying to submit it, because I thought, this is a great story. I am ready to be published. I have done all of my homework. This is a great story. And I had to step away from it a little bit to realize the flaw was the main character was a kid named Noah. Noah had no passion. And he did internally. Like, I could see where it was, but it never came through. And so what would happen is Noah would just have things happen to him, and then he would kind of react to it. But he was kind of passive. And so the reader could never connect with Noah. And so for everything I thought this story had going, I failed in my number one task, which was a riveting main character. It was completely unpublishable for that reason. Yes, sir.
How do you do that when it's kind of an underdog character? You know, you're trying to kind of a rags to riches type of thing. I mean, because a lot of times it's because they've been kind of pushed down or so forth that they come across as passive. I don't know. How do you deal with that?
There is, if you look at like passive characters in like real psychology world, right? There is, I don't know if any of you know color code. I was huge on color code and stuff. So you have red and blue are these active, forceful sorts of characters. They're the ones who are just pushers and movers. Then you have yellow and white are the more passive characters. You would be talking about a white, right?
Probably.
Okay, so whites, because whites tend to be the ones that you think of as the passives. The thing that's very interesting, whites are like deep rivers. And you look to the top of the river and it doesn't look like there's a current and you think, oh, that's an easy swim. And you get into those waters and you realize it's the undercurrent that is pushing. Whites are actually, that passive character, tend to be the very strongest personality. Okay. They're just better at hiding it. So if you have a character like that who's going to be a little bit more passive on the surface, you give them these strong, strong currents underneath that push everything forward. What that generally means is you give them a fight. Something that they'll take it and take it and take it, but they will not cross this one line. And so if you give them that one thing, so you could say, okay, if you read Hatchet, anybody? Gary Paulson's Hatchet. All right, so it's the story of a kid whose plane crash lands in the Canadian wilderness, and it's this kid against the Canadian wilderness. I would consider him to be pretty passive. He spends, you know, the first several days after the crash just kind of curled up in a ball, not sure what he's going to do, and he just kind of subsists. And it takes a while. But his passion is his family, and it's wanting to see, you know, get back to his mom and stuff. And as passive as he is, he has that current. And so you're looking for the current in your character. Okay, they act and react, all right? Which means that you want a main character who pushes forward the motion of the story. So you don't want a character who's just watching it happen. You want to have a character that's making it happen. And then a character that reacts to everything that happens. And so that you've got this character who's constantly involved. When you do that, you have a character-driven story. Those are the stories that middle graders will connect to. Is characters that are pushing the plot along and then reacting to when they get pushed back. Third, you want a main character that has purpose. It's one of the reasons I loved Meg, if you remember, in Wrinkle in Time. Those of you who have read it, you know, Meg's got the it, and it's kind of like pushing this rhythm, trying to control her mind. And Meg is fighting back against that mind control, and it's her purpose, which is saving her brother, who is the passion, because that's who she loves. And it is Meg's drive to save her brother by which she's able to resist that huge power that's coming against her. Finally, and fourth, you want a character that feels real. This is where we're going to talk about voice, and do they need to talk like middle graders talk today? And this is, I think, just a really important thing to understand. A lot of times when we're writing middle grade, we try, because we're all adults in here, right? Like, I haven't been a middle grader for, 30 years, you know, since I was kind of there. And so, you know, if I want to talk like a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old, I am not going to do it. You know, like, hey, dude, man, you know, I'm going to sound so dorky, and my 13-year-old daughter is going to be like, please, Mom, stop. And so it's not going to work. You need to know, middle graders will read J.R.R. Tolkien, The Hobbit, who is, you know, 60, 70 years ago sorts of language, which is very formal, very scholarly sorts of language. They will read J.R.R. Tolkien and eat it up. They will read Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which is very casual, has not a shred of literary merit in it. They will read J.K. Rowling, who is British, and the humor is British in nature. They will read, they are not looking for their own voice, they are looking for an authentic voice. That's your voice, all right? When you are writing, you are looking for your voice, not trying to sound like a middle grader, like you think they talk, like you think they think. You are looking for your voice, all right? Your communication with them. And if you have a character that they care about, they will read your voice. So go for who you are, and they will read that. Does that help, sir, on your question from before on voice to use? Okay, number two, dialogue that leaps off the page. This one is, writers either tend to get dialogue and be really good at it, or they tend to really struggle with dialogue, and it always kind of sounds artificial, or it's just plain boring. I'm going to take you through a few tips, and then if you really struggle, I'm going to tell you how to fix it. So you're going to look for these four characteristics in great dialogue. Number one, realistic. Realistic, if you listen to actual people talking, it's pretty boring. And we do a lot of incomplete sentences, we repeat ourselves, we misstate a word. Not that kind of realistic. They are looking for this character who I like, that's exactly what they would say. And so you're looking for that to the character to sound like what the kid expects for them to sound like. Not that it could just be a tape recording of an actual conversation, because that's boring. Number two, they want something that's crisp. So you're looking for something that's succinct, exactly to the point. It's going to just kind of drive it home. You're looking for, if a character says something, when the next character responds, that it's fluid, that it just seems to flow very conversationally, but not drag on and on. Number three, they're looking for consistency. Sage is a contrast, because he is mouthy and kind of snarky all the times, but he also speaks from the heart a lot. And so I can have Sage respond either ones of those ways. But Sage, just because of who he is, he's a brat. Sage is never going to thank somebody. He's not going to be like, hey, thank you so much. It's just not him to do it. And so if all of a sudden I have Sage going around and thanking everybody, either I've got to have a really good reason for it, or it's going to sound out of place. And number four, occasionally unexpected. So every so often, I might throw in a thank you from Sage, because the fact that he's actually gone into the trouble to thank somebody is going to stand out, and it's going to surprise the reader, because they know that's not in him to respond in that way. So every so often, you're going to want a character to respond that way. I remember reading Harry Potter 5, which is Order of the Phoenix, which completely stressed me out because, what's her name? The new professor. She was Umbridge.
Yeah.
I hated her more than Voldemort, really.
Yeah.
Like, at the end, I was kind of like, why don't you take out Umbridge? Because Voldemort, he's got some, you know, he's got a point, but she's just horrible. And she stressed me out. I could not sleep. And I remember when Harry, you know, he's getting it carved into his hand, the, you know, don't tell lies into his hand, and Hermione is asking him why he just doesn't speak up, because he's not telling anybody in authority about what's happening. And I don't remember exactly what his response was, but his justification for not speaking up, it made sense, it was logical, I just didn't expect it coming from him. And so it was such this great scene, because I didn't see it coming in just that way. Umbridge. Gosh, it was awful. All right, number three, high-stakes conflict. The reason I put Frodo up there, because I think in children's literature, this is probably the highest stake of all. This is right up there with Harry Potter and stuff. I mean, this is save Middle-earth from ultimate evil. And it was such a... I mean, at least Harry in against Voldemort had a wand, right? Frodo's got nothing. He's got nothing. And he's a hobbit. He's like smaller than a person. And he's got nothing. And it's him against Sauron and the One Ring, which he's carrying. And I was stressed out during that. I'm kind of a stress bucket. And so it's such a great conflict. That's why this book was so big. There are... No matter what kind of book you're writing, you want your stakes to be as high as possible. Not just if you're writing some high fantasy, any book that you are writing, you need to look at the stakes for your hero. Number one, it goes back to a riveting main character. You want a hero that readers care about, where they're worried about him. In False Prince, there's four orphans, and one of them is going to get chosen to be impersonating a prince. Three of them are going to be killed. And so the reader knows really early on that three-fourths of those kids are going to be killed, and one of them is committing treason. And so if I can get them to care about Sage to where they really like him, and then they realize Sage very well could die before the end of this, they're going to be worried, and my stakes are high. So high stakes for the hero. Let me talk about that for a minute. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I just have a question about how this works if you do temporary.
Okay, yeah.
When you don't have magic, they're not saving the world. How do you do that?
Okay, let me give you a couple of examples from contemporary. So there's an author in Salt Lake City, a good friend of mine named Sarah Williams. Sarah wrote a book called Palace Beautiful. Palace Beautiful takes place in present-day Salt Lake City, and it's a girl is moving into this new house, and she is worried. Her mother had died in childbirth years ago, and her father remarried, and now stepmom is near to be having her baby, and it looks like there may be some complications, and this girl, who has bonded now to the stepmother, is feeling like it is a cycle of what already happened to her with the loss of her mother. And this girl is kind of holding it all in, all of these worries that maybe her stepmother will die too. And all of a sudden, as far as that little girl is concerned, her stakes are as high as Frodo's, because it is, what if I lose my stepmother too? There's another one. A woman named Audrey Vernick wrote a book called Water Balloon that came out earlier this year. Water the Balloon is these three girls who have been best friends forever. And one of the girls, her parents have gotten a divorce, and now she's got to go live for the summer with dad. And so they're in the same town, but she's not quite as close to these friends, and now she's having some different experiences. And so it kind of pulled her away from that little trio a little bit. And what she starts to see happening over the summer is these two girls who were where they're at, they're just getting closer and closer, and she's getting further and further away. And all of a sudden, and they're at this starting junior high, and so all of their lives are changing, and it's her all of a sudden realizing she's losing her friends. And so, again, it's not these huge life or stakes things, but in her world, everything is collapsing. And so, so I come from a theater background. I'm a theater major, and one of the early bits of advice that I loved in talking about stakes is somebody told me every scene on stage is a life or death scene. And at first I thought that was crazy, because I'm like, well, that's not even possible that every scene can be a life or death scene. And once I got to understand it, let's say the scene is, Mom, I want to go to the store, and Mom says, no, you can't go to the store. So you could play it just as a straight, flat scene. And Mom, I want to go to the store. Nope, you can't go to the store. All right, what do I care? That's boring. That is boring. So what you have to do is you have to raise the stakes. And so it's like, what if your character has to get to the store? What if in your character's world, that is the biggest thing that has to happen? And so now it's like, Mom, I have to get to the store today. It doesn't matter. There's a sale on candy bars, you know, but they have to get to the store. And they are going to keep pushing. And Mom says, nope, you can't go to the store. No, Mom, I have to get there. And all of a sudden, something as stupid and trite as a visit to the store is a high-stakes scene. So it's not about the actual events. It's about making your characters care enough that everything matters. The third one, very, very important, a powerful villain who's likely to win. It doesn't necessarily mean Voldemort. When it is Gary Paulson's Hatchet, the villain is Mother Nature. It is this kid who is up against the Canadian wilderness and has no freaking clue what he is doing. All right? You need to make your villain stronger than your hero. Always. Always. If your villain is crazy, bumbling, you know, gum-chewing stupid, they're completely uninterested. Your villain is always, whatever your protagonist, your hero, comes up against, it really should be your villain who's likely to win. Yes?
Now, how soon should the villain show up in the story?
It varies. I think that your publishers will love it if you can trot that villain out earlier rather than later, but always you can't do it. In which case, you definitely want to get your character bumping up against some sort of trouble very, very soon. If we go to Harry Potter, I mean, when you first meet him, he's a kid with the Dursleys, and you know there's something different about him. You don't really get introduced to Voldemort directly for a long, long time. But Harry has the Dursleys, who he's up against, and you know that the Dursleys, they put him in this cupboard beneath the stairs, and he's, you know, they keep throwing away his mail. And so even though Harry hasn't hit his antagonist yet, he is already bumping against obstacles. And that's how J.K. Rowling got everything going before you met the grand villain. And you may not have. If it's water balloon and it's a girl whose friendships are breaking up, it's not a villain. It's these other two girls. But you know what? She's still likely to lose. These other two girls and the friendship that's deteriorating, it's going to go that way. She's not going to just magically happily ever after it. Okay, number four, vivid settings. This is from the movie Hugo, which is from Brian Selznick's Hugo Cabaret. And I chose this one because I thought his setting, I mean, he's got, you know, that late 19th century, early 20th century sort of a setting of a train station in Britain. And it was just such a gorgeous setting. Hugo, a lot of the reason that it costs so much money to make is because of the energy they put into setting. Because Selznick, in his book, you know, did these drawings to make these vivid, vivid scenes for kids. And Martin Scorsese, in making the movie, felt he had to stay true to Selznick's settings. And so in as you're doing settings, use senses. For middle graders, they really respond well to the use of senses. What does a place smell like? What is the feel of a place? You know, is it really musty? What does that smell like? Is the air really thick and it's pushing in on them and they can feel the pressure of the air against their skin? Middle graders, they're very sensory aware, and so as much as you can use senses to describe it, they will respond to that. You're usually going to be doing A or B. Either it's the familiar, like school, home, places that they know, and you're going to want to explore it in a new way. So you take the thing that they know, and you're like, oh, but look, this is how this place is a little bit different. It's how it's a little bit unique. And again, you bring that out in senses. You can have a school. We all know what an elementary school is like. But what if there's like a really weird permanent odor that comes from the cafeteria of the school? And it makes all the kids really suspicious about what are they feeding? Why does it always smell, you know, like, oh gosh, I can't even think of something, you know, tangerines. But they never eat tangerines for lunch, but it always smells like tangerines. And so you've used something that every kid knows, but you've introduced this element that's new. Or B, you have the new, something they've never seen before, introduced in an exciting way. That's what made Hogwarts so cool. That's why book one did as well as it did, because book one isn't this huge adventure for most of the time. Like, not a lot happens, to be honest. But nobody had ever seen anything like Hogwarts before. And so it's the way that she introduced it that made a new thing exciting. Okay, and last, movement of plot. If writers for young people are going to get a criticism, or really all authors, if you're going to get a criticism, it's most often this one, and it goes like this. Oh, it took me forever to get into this book, but about halfway I was hooked and then I liked it. Or it had this huge, great beginning and then the middle it just got boring and slow. Or it was this great climax and then everything just kind of fell off. And what happens is too often in books we run into the challenge of moving the plot forward. There's a lot of writers, look, I'm not a literary writer. If I try for literary, it's just awful. And it's because I think it's boring to read really long passages of beautiful words. I just kind of like skip for the next action. It's why I really work well in middle grade books, because that's how middle graders read. You know, if you're this gorgeous literary writer, just keep it short and succinct. and keep your plot moving forward, that there's always something. And you think about that river. What you want to do is you want to put your reader on a raft, and you're sending them down the Colorado. All right? And sometimes it's going to be just kind of a slow, beautiful, casual ride, and then sometimes it's rapids ahead, and the kid wants, you know, is going to hold on to that raft and get down the rapids. But always, 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 they're moving down the river. What you don't want is to have places in your plot. If you've ever been down a river, you know when it happens. The current kind of pulls you off to the shore, and all of a sudden you're like getting your foot in the ground, like keep yourself going down the river because you've stalled out at the shore. That is just always to be avoided for young readers. Here is how you manage it. Number one, maximize action. Oh, I have to go back really quickly. I told you on dialogue. I was going to tell you, if you struggle with dialogue, here is how to fix it. Read plays. Put down books, pick up plays. Because plays are straight dialogue. And you will and just read them and read them and read them. It doesn't matter what play. It's for you to get an ear for dialogue. And so if you struggle, read plays, not books. Just plays. Okay, now we're back here. Maximize action. So you want to make sure that you are always coming from a big event or headed to a big event. You don't want big passages of philosophy, description, your character thinking about something. You are coming from action and your character is resting. You are in the middle of action and your character is acting. Or you are leaving action and your character is recovering. But never just sitting there. Number two, start as often as you can with the plot in motion. When you first meet Sage, Sage is carrying, he's just stolen a roast. And the butcher caught him, and the butcher is chasing after him. The butcher has his cleaver going, and he's throwing the cleaver, trying to hit Sage and just kill him right there for the roast thievery. And Sage is struggling because the roast is more slippery than he had anticipated it being. And so he's running for his life, but he doesn't want to drop the roast because he's hungry. And he's having trouble holding it. And so it's the very first time you meet Sage, you get to understand some things about him. Number one, he's a thief. Number two, he's pretty impetuous. Number three, he's an unrepentant thief. And you start to learn all of these things about him. I'm going to tell you, if you are about ready to submit your manuscript to a editor, and it starts with your character either in a dream or waking up, scrap it and start again. Just because about one in every three manuscripts that crosses an editor's or an agent's desk starts with the character waking up or in the middle of a dream. And so there is no quicker way to get your manuscript shut and rejected than by starting that way. So even though it might be brilliant the way you use it, just don't. Just don't. It's kind of like right up there with "It was a dark and stormy night" type of thing. All right, number four, end of chapter hooks. What you really want to do is you want to ruin kids' sleep schedules. And if you can be a little bit responsible for them not getting sleep, you have done your job. So I'll tell you, the happiest moment by far for me of this month is the author of the Goosebumps series, whose name is R.L. Stine. R.L. Stine tweeted about the false prince this week.
Nice.
And what he said is, he said some nice things, but one of the things he said is he stayed up way too late because he could not put the book down. Mm-hmm. All right? That single sentence that, like, the author of the Goosebumps, he could not put my book down, it's end of chapter hooks. And what it is you want to end in such a way that the reader says, maybe one more, maybe just one more. And so you persuade them in. My very favorite chapter ending on False Prince is Sage. He's at the nobleman's house named Connor, and he's pushed Connor too far. He's stolen something from Connor, and he won't tell Connor where it is, and he won't give it back. And Connor orders Sage to be taken to the dungeon. And Sage, what he says is, all I knew is that he would not get that rock. It's a rock. He stole a rock. All I knew is that he would not get that rock, even if my life depended on it, and I suspected that it did. And the chapter ends. And so you know the very next place he's heading is the dungeon. And Like, I know how it ends. If I'm browsing my own book, I will still read on. And I know how it goes because I think it's a great hook. And I think if you can do hooks, you will keep your editor moving forward and your reader. Finally, stay true to your unique voice, which means let me catch you in a minute. Let me do this one, and then I'll get your question for sure. Your unique voice. You've got to trust who you are as a writer. For me, before I was published, that right there is what kept me from being published because I was either trying to follow grammatical rules, I was trying to sound like somebody else who was already published once, and then I came to this point at the end of Apprentice to Madman. I had been submitting so many times and failing that I just said, all right, bag it. I'm going to write something that I have no intention of publishing. And so I wrote something that was my voice. That's the one that sold. And it was because I stayed true to my voice and wasn't trying to be somebody else. Okay, yes, ma'am, you had it.
I was just going to ask, do you put a book at the end of every single chapter?
I do.
Like Hardy Boys?
Yeah, and in fact, I was a huge Hardy Boys fan. It's probably where it came from. They're not all like literal cliffhanger things because I think that gets really trite. But every end does beckon. It kind of gives a hint to the reader of that there's a reason they should keep reading. And it's not always the characters in danger, you know. It could be, you know, there's one chapter where Sage is going to sleep and he realizes that they are standing right at the edge of treason. And so he's in no immediate danger. He just finally realizes that what they are doing is treason. And that's his last thought as he goes to sleep. And so I will always put in something that says, you know, do you want to just read one more? Let me just go ahead. All right? So that's that. Any questions you guys have, either about the presentation or just about the general author world? Yes, again.
Okay, you said that your manuscript went to auction, which all of us here are fantasizing about, but could you please tell us what that meant?
Yeah. We submitted false prints on its, we submitted to 6 publishers. 4 of the publishers came back and said, we're going to offer on this. And so my agent said, okay, Wednesday it's going to auction. The way that an auction works is literally like it sounds. And so she would say, you have by 10 a.m., you know, you 4 editors, you have by 10 a.m. to put in your best bid, financial terms, whatever. And then she takes the 4 bids and she and I sit with the 4 bids and say, all right, this is our 3 favorites. And then she notifies the 3 favorites, all right, you have another round to bid, give us your best, and it goes up and up from there. That's an auction. Preempt, Tuesday afternoon, my current editor, his name is Lisa. Lisa calls my agent and she says, we don't want to lose this manuscript. What'll it take to pull it out of auction? That is like golden world, right? Because now my agent and I sit down and say, ooh, what do we want to charge Scholastic for this, or what terms? We set the terms and take them to Scholastic. And so it's, and for me, I'm not a big person on like getting the most money that I can. I mean, I would be really happy if they wanted to give me a lot of money. That's cool. I wanted terms and I wanted a trilogy because I felt like that Sage's story was bigger than one book and I wanted a guarantee of 3 books. And they were like, okay, you know, stupid author. Like, yeah, we'll give you your 3. You know, and so they accepted right away. And I mean, we had nice finances and stuff, but it's just getting anybody to buy off is amazing. Auction is cool. Preempt was a really happy day. So it'll never happen again for me, but it was a really happy day. Any other questions? Yes?
Just in general for middle grade, like what would you say is just overdone? Like don't even try? Or, I mean, I know I've heard you can put a spin on anything. There's got to be, you know, like YA dystopia.
Yeah.
I know there's spins you can do, but I hear from other people just don't go to certain areas.
Don't go to where everything is right now. So as you look at like the top 20 middle grade books, don't write anything like any of those, because if it's hitting the top 10 or top 20, they are getting, you know, they're comparing, you know, like David Levithan is the editor of Hunger Games, and because David is Scholastic, so False Prints gets pitched a lot as the here's your next Hunger Games. They can do that because it's their book. They have 20 books a day saying we're the next Hunger Games, and they get pitches. This is like Hunger Games meets you know, in Diary of a Wimpy Kid, whatever they've got. And and so whatever is big right now, write anything else. My gut instinct is that the trend is moving towards science fiction and suspense and horror, and which is kind of a problem for me since I don't write any of that. Maybe I will now. Okay, yes.
How scary can you get? Good. In middle grade? I mean, we know Harry Potter, but I mean, really, how scary can you actually get?
Okay, my theory on middle grade is you can do every single thing in middle grade that you would do in a YA. You just might not be as detailed about it. You take it a little bit off. End of Goblet of Fire, Harry is positively, absolutely tortured. Full scale, like if a movie version was ever made of the ending of Goblet of Fire, it would have to be an R-rated movie because he is full on tortured in the graveyard at the end. And but J.K. Rowling doesn't show you every minute of that. She doesn't go into the detail of it, but it's, you know, she's like, that's the Cruciatus curse, and you know what that means. And so what you do is you can do anything you want, you just take it off camera. When Sage is taken to the dungeon, he's whipped. And I talk about it happening, you know, I describe how it feels, but I'm not graphic about it at all. So I take it just a little bit off camera. But I think all topics are open. Yes?
Where would you go to find a listing of what are the top 20 middle school?
For me, I would go to Amazon because they have very updated lists. Or just look at the New York Times bestseller lists. You know, if you just Google this week, New York Times bestseller, and look at the children's lists, it's going to be Suzanne Collins, everything she's ever written, Rick Riordan, everything he's ever written, and then like one or two other books that sneak in there. So those are the big ones. If you're doing a Percy Jackson anything or a Suzanne Collins. And I'll tell you, you know, you asked the question about subject matter. If I'm in visiting elementary schools, I'll ask the kids, hey, what are you guys reading? What do you like? Their top two books right now that the middle graders, fifth and sixth graders are reading, number one, Hunger Games. Number two, Twilight. So if you're thinking that sixth grader, maybe this is too strong for them, Hunger Games, Twilight. That's what they're reading right now.
And their parents bought it for them.
Because, well, I will tell you this. Generally speaking, middle graders can handle way more than we adults give them credit for. They are much, much more savvy to the world around them than we think. Most middle graders, okay, I'm not a Twilight fan at all. I would not give my daughter, she's 13, she's still not getting Twilight. Hunger Games, I was like, I think you will get the concept of this. I think we don't give our middle graders credit enough. Now, my second grader, he's not reading it for
I'd almost
years.
Be more worried about the teenagers than the middle graders sometimes.
Seriously, but you got to trust the kids. They can handle. I'm going to officially dismiss you guys because I know you have places to go. If you want to stay and ask questions or just come up to me personally, that's totally great. Thank you all very much for coming.